B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, December 15th, 2016. This is the day Donald Trump promised he'd hold a news conference and explain how he would prevent any kinds of conflicts of interest between his business enterprises and his service to the nation. Ah, but never mind. You know, I mean, come on. He's Donald. He's above it all. Conflicts? Ha! They're everywhere. And we are learning that Yahoo, in 2013, 3 years ago, suffered a bigger hack than the one that they exposed this past summer that only affected about half a billion users. They're now admitting that in 2013, hackers, still unidentified, possibly state actors, but hey, that's a pretty common ruse now, that a billion accounts were compromised. Now, I have used Yahoo for a long time. I've kind of dialed back. My peter@peterbcollins.com email address used to go into a Yahoo account. That's how I managed my public email. And I moved away about a year ago because of the hacks and because Yahoo is a company that is kind of crumbling internally. It is in the process of being sold to Verizon for just under $5 billion, and chances are that price tag will be reduced as a result of these security breaches that clearly damage the brand of Yahoo. And one thing that's unclear from the reporting is whether the hackers ran off with the exclamation point that Yahoo uses in its corporate logo. I'm not seeing it used in any of the news accounts of this breach. But it's getting more and more bizarre. Yesterday, I shared with you a little blurb from the War of the Worlds, that fake news report from 1938 that put the nation on edge because Martians were attacking in New Jersey. Well, I feel like it's just getting more and more out of control. Last night, NBC News, again, without any facts, simply telling us that two different national security figures, who will not give their names, have asserted that Vladimir Putin personally instructed how the material hacked from U.S. Democrats was leaked and how it was disseminated. And it quotes two unnamed senior officials with access to this information. So we just got a pile of leaks based on unknown numbers of anonymous official leakers. As I pointed out, I hope you're not getting too tired of this, Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning have to be experiencing a lot of heartburn over this. To see these people leak with impunity, construct this narrative that Russia is responsible, then build on that house of cards, this very astounding claim that Putin himself was sitting there, you know, rifling through these leaked emails and documents and saying, oh yeah, have Assange send this over to so-and-so. And yeah, let's divert this one into the Florida congressional campaign where we're trying to... I mean, it's like he was sitting there with a map of the United States and targeting people with this stolen information. And I just find this really hard to believe. And I don't doubt that as a former KGB man, that Putin might like to play spook every now and then. You know, maybe he takes his shirt off and hops on that horse. But come on, this is so insulting that not a shred of evidence is provided. And the NBC report goes on to say that they have a high level of confidence in this assessment. What kind of bullshit is that? And they even ascribe motive here, again, with zero attribution. Putin has reportedly never forgiven Clinton when she was Secretary of State for publicly questioning the integrity of parliamentary elections in Russia in 2011 and accused her of encouraging street protests. Now, that may or may not be true. But this is cartoonish. that we're being served up these assertions based on unnamed intelligence officials. And again, this attribution, the intelligence officials told NBC that Putin's goals in the alleged hacking began as revenge, but they transformed into a broader effort to show the world that U.S. politics is corrupt, and in the words of one official, to split off key American allies by creating the image that other countries couldn't depend on the U.S. to be a credible global leader anymore. This is soap opera script writing. And I am just appalled to see most of the United States population falling into line like sheeple behind this phony narrative. Now, for what it's worth, and this, of course, is dismissed like used toilet paper here in the United States, the TASS News Service has released statements that the Kremlin considers ludicrous. The media reports that Putin personally influenced the results of the U.S. presidential elections. Spokesman at the Kremlin, Dmitry Peskov, said on Thursday that he could characterize these reports as ludicrous nonsense. They cannot have any grounds. That's kind of butchered in the translation. And then Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia. I was astonished when I saw it. I think this is nothing but nonsense. There is not a chance that anybody could believe that. There's a page turn there, sorry. NBC earlier alleged, citing high-ranking sources in the U.S. Secret Services, that the Russian president was personally involved in the efforts. So then the New York Times, riding atop this this house of cards, this castle of sand, lectures Trump in an editorial today, and it once again repeats these assertions as fact. It opens, "No matter how divided our politics and our times, Americans can agree that our status as a strong democratic nation rests on the bedrock of free and fair elections. That confidence is what was targeted when Russia, one of our oldest, most determined foreign adversaries, invaded American computer networks and released thousands of pages of documents to undermine the legitimacy of the 2016 election." Now, right out the gate here, they are asserting, with no evidence, with no facts, that this is true. And it still flies in the face of the critical knowledge of veterans of the intelligence community that this is much more likely an insider leak than an outsider hack. But that's inconvenient, so it is swept away, and, oh, we just don't bring it up. And these gullible Americans with their limited attention spans and their remotes at the ready to change the channel as soon as they get bored, they swallow it hook, line, and sinker. Then we get Mike Rogers, our chief spook, who runs the NSA and the Cyber Command. He said there shouldn't be any doubt in anybody's mind. That doesn't prove anything. This, again, is psychology applied on a mass scale. Rogers went on to say this wasn't something that was done casually. It was not something done by chance. This was not a target that was selected purely arbitrarily. This was a conscious effort by a nation state to attempt to achieve a specific effect. Then fucking prove it, Rogers. You're sitting on the data. You could prove from your intercepts who hacked the DNC, if the DNC was in fact hacked. And you could show us who did the phishing, the malicious software that got John Podesta to change his password and allow leakers or hackers or whoever they were to flood us with his personal communications. But instead, we get a pile of louder, more adamant assertions and no proof. And the Times editorial trots us through the claims that there were contacts between Moscow and the Trump campaign. That was admitted by a deputy foreign minister in November. We don't know what those contacts were about. We know that Paul Manafort was a political consultant in Ukraine. We know that the nominee, Rex Tillerson, for Secretary of State, is a close buddy of Putin's. They've done oil deals together. But none of this amounts to any proof or evidence that there was hacking directed by Putin and run by Russian intelligence. And so we're in a very, very fuzzy state of mind here. And we could see investigations that could clarify this, but your typical 9/11 commission or any of these other whitewash junkets, it's not going to change very much. And we're at risk that the United States is going to launch retaliatory actions against Russia without any proof of this. And so covert wars will continue. And it's just a really disgusting cycle. So at the White House yesterday, Josh, who is Ernest, the White House press secretary, said that President Obama held back. He did not want to be perceived as meddling in an election where he had endorsed Hillary Clinton. And so he let the spook, Jimmy Clapper, go public on October 7th. Speaking for the administration, although Obama didn't give it his blessing or indicate that he agreed with the assertions made by Clapper and Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson on October 7th. And the New York Times report here says the administration's delayed response also resulted because Trump had been making repeated claims about how the election was being rigged, and Obama didn't want to do anything that would feed those charges. And so I don't extend any credibility to any current government official on this, whether it's Barack Obama, the Democrats who are chomping at the bit to blame Hillary's bad candidacy on outside interference. And Josh Ernest, the final comment here, he said that much of the damage from the Russian hack resulted from decisions by news organizations to publish emails they knew to be stolen. Well, come on. The media has published purloined documents since the beginning of documents. It's a time-honored art, tradition, and precedent in this country. And not a single one of those emails has been shown to have been manipulated or in any way changed. This is information the American public deserved to know once it was in play. And so the hypocrisy, the double talk, as you can tell, is really driving me up a wall. And then we got this guy Trump. And he's back on his Twitter machine. Couldn't even spell it properly. He said if Russia or some other entity was hacking, why did the White House wait, W-A-I-T-E, so long to act? Why did they only complain after Hillary lost? Well, that doesn't help because it's easy to take that apart, to unpack it and say, well, there was the October 7th statement, Donald. Where were you? Well, you were busy defending from your pussy-grabbing comment. That's where you were on October the 7th. So, nobody comes out of this looking good. And I think that we will never know the truth. At some point, I will have to yield to the consensus bullshit perspective. Oh, yeah, Russia manipulated the 2016 election. Because it takes on a life of its own. And we end up with these separate narratives where we can't communicate anymore. And I blame the media for not being critical and skeptical and buying into this package of rarefied horse droppings. Okay, back to the Trump circus. We are learning that they're going to push the envelope on the anti-nepotism law and allow Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, to become advisors and have offices in the White House. According to Kellyanne Conway, the anti-nepotism law apparently has an exception if you want to work in the West Wing because the president is able to appoint his own staff. Yeah, we just make this up as we go along. And Conway said that whichever children went into the White House, they'd need a complete distinction and separation from Trump business ties, which she called a sacrifice for them. But there aren't going to be any blind trust. We're all just going to be told, oh, yeah, they're there to work for you. They're not going to use their positions to enrich the Trump family or advance their business interests. Yeah, just trust them. This is preposterous. It does lay the groundwork for impeachment proceedings. Because on the somebody's pointed out, I read today, that on the day he takes office, Trump would be in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. But you really think the Republican House is going to bring impeachment charges against their guy? It would take quite a development for that to occur. Now, a few minutes ago, I referenced Jimmy Clapper. He is the proven perjurer whose days are numbered as the Director of National Intelligence. He submitted his resignation. He'll be out on Inauguration Day. And Jeremy Scahill, who's a very interesting reporter, he has discovered that James Clapper has a blog. And at The Intercept today, Scahill reports that the name of that secret blog is Intercept. Yeah, it's only accessible to people within the intelligence community with clearance to access government intelligence. It has a secret RSS feed, so analysts will never miss a post. And it also allows comments. So Scahill somehow was somebody shared at least one of the posts on Clapper's blog with him, and he allows comments from the members of the intelligence community who read his blog. And he was probably surprised when he got blowback from his loyal employees after he received a letter of support from an American citizen, and Clapper grabbed a pen and wrote a handwritten note back to this person. We don't know who it is. But this is a person who said that it's okay with him. He's got nothing to hide. He's willing to sacrifice his civil liberties for greater security. And he ended his note to Clapper by saying, "We support you." So Clapper wrote back, "I can't tell you how much I appreciate your letter of April 27th. I say this on behalf of all the women and men of the intelligence community. In my view, you have very accurately described the issue that the Boston bombing represent. Just how small do the American people want the holes in the security fishnet to be? Thanks for taking the time to write such a thoughtful letter." But what Clapper probably didn't expect is that some of his employees would take exception to his little love note exchange. The first two people who comment, one said, "I think it was inappropriate for the DNI to respond in a way that indicates he agrees with the premise of the writer's letter, namely, that government must expand its domestic watching and the people must give up some rights in the interest of the greater good. The head of the U.S. intelligence community, the business of which is foreign intelligence, should not be taking sides on matters of domestic intelligence policy." Hey, right on. There's some people who know about the Bill of Rights who work in the spy community. Then somebody who used the screen name Wormy warned Clapper against being too quick to release your freedoms and rights in the name of security. And Wormy is right on, too. He or she wrote, "We can't be ridding ourselves of certain rights, such as those outlined by the Fourth Amendment. They will absolutely not guarantee our security or freedom from attack." Wormy also added, "Be careful about surrendering rights. History shows that governments don't have a great track record of giving them back once they've taken them." Ain't that the truth? Wormy had further comments. "Do you want to be part of the generation that threw it all out because a group of Islamic radicals is posing a threat to you that statistically doesn't even come close to the threat posed to you by lightning?" Wow. That kind of made my day. The other thing that makes my day is that people like you support my work through your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Jeff Lipinski, Don Cisney, Andrew Michaelets just took out a new annual subscription. Thanks, Andrew. And Julie Dupree, she's been aboard for a whole long time. I'd like you to join their ranks if you've never heard your name mentioned here. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You know the drill. Click menu, pull it down, click become a subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page. We got bonus books displayed in case you want to take out a $50 annual subscription. You can also choose $5, $10, or $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution. You can bypass PayPal by mailing a cash or check contribution to the P.O. box that's listed on that page. Whatever floats your boat. And if you would like to set up a gift subscription for a friend, colleague, or loved one, I'll be happy to arrange that for you. Just email Peter at peterbcollins.com. Also, just in the holiday spirit, I want to mention that the crowdfunding campaign, the GoFundMe campaign for Roger and Carol Shuler, is starting to take off. But there's a lot more that needs to be done to help the courageous journalist and his wife. So I will link once again in the show file to this podcast, and I ask you to be as generous as you are able. Interesting resistance from Republicans surfacing to the Trump picks for the State Department. Now, there are some people who are uncomfortable with Rex Tillerson, the ExxonMobil chief, but even more people are willing to publicly say they can't support John Bolton as an assistant secretary of state. And it's coming from interesting people like Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican who chairs foreign relations, Rand Paul of Kentucky, who said, you know, there's something to be said for one of the top diplomats in the country being diplomatic. And Bolton, who is a ball buster of a guy, famously said that he wanted to blow up the top four floors of the United Nations. That was before Bush named him UN ambassador. So the other interesting thing that surfaced is that Rex Tillerson has expressed misgivings about having Bolton as his deputy. But Bolton's ace is that Sheldon Adelson, the pro-Israel big pockets donor to the Republican Party, continues to back Mr. Bolton, and he also has the support of Jared Kushner, the son-in-law I mentioned a few minutes ago. So what is also ironic here is that last week Trump attacked the faulty intelligence, you know, assessments linking the predictions about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction to the what I consider to be the phony claims about Russian hacking in the elections, and said that, you know, the same people who gave us the war in Iraq are giving us this assessment on Russia. But those same people include John Bolton, who was a big promoter of the invasion of Iraq and didn't have time for any of the details that got in the way of his prefab policy notions. Interesting and ugly move in North Carolina yesterday. The legislature, controlled by Republicans, suddenly called a special session. Now, they had just completed one special session to deal with the recent natural disaster relief. But they decided to call a new session and use their power while they still have a Republican governor to ram through legislation to limit the power of the governor going forward, because that governor in January is going to be a Democrat. And as you know, Pat McCrory, the Republican, refused to concede defeat for almost a month, scrambling to find some way to rig the election in his favor because he thought he had already managed to do that. So now the Republicans have rammed through measures that require state Senate approval of governor's cabinet members, cut the number of state employees he can appoint by something like two-thirds, giving civil service protections to Republicans who are burrowed in right now. And if the Republican lame duck governor signs off on this, then the new guy who takes office in January, Roy Cooper, is going to be a governor light. And because, of course, he won't control either house of the legislature, they essentially have put velvet handcuffs on him. This is a really scurrilous action. This is raw power, banana republic style, being used in North Carolina. And I don't think that there's any way this can be stopped. Only the limitless, how can I put this? The Republicans in North Carolina have no shame. So only shame can kick in to prevent them from overreaching here, and there's no indication that they will find that. And some of the issues, you know, stem from the way the Republicans rammed through SB2 in North Carolina, the transgender bathroom law that has cost them all kinds of boycotts and other reactions. Well, over in Louisiana, Governor John Bel Edwards, who is just barely a Democrat, I mean, he's as conservative a Democrat as they come, but to his credit, he issued an order back in April to try to protect the rights of state employees who are LGBT or Q. And this is a constant struggle in Louisiana. When a Democrat sits in the governor's chair, he will pass these protections by executive order, and when a Republican takes over, they are rescinded. So as part of this little game back and forth, Bel Edwards signed this last April. But a Republican state senator, a lawmaker, has challenged him in court. And his name is Landry. He brought a lawsuit, and State District Judge Todd Hernandez has sided with Landry. He struck down the governor's order, ruling that the governor cannot create laws with executive orders. And so what we're seeing here is Republicans using underhanded tactics to try to game the system when they don't get their way, usually an effort to discriminate through normal channels. In Syria, we are learning that evacuations from eastern Aleppo have begun this morning. A convoy of buses and ambulances were confirmed to have left the rebel-held areas of the besieged Syrian city. The evacuation had been set to start yesterday, but a ceasefire negotiated between Russia and Turkey broke down shortly after it was announced. And it's very hard from here to find any people with white hats, and I'm including the so-called white helmet rescue personnel who don't appear to be completely independent. And certainly scores are going to be settled. This civil war is heading into its sixth year, and it has been ugly and divisive, and I'm not in any way trying to rationalize the settling of scores, but it's going to be ugly. And a lot of people have been killed already. The Syrian forces have summarily executed some people as they are attempting to escape from Aleppo. And it's anybody's guess how that could be justified. Now, maybe they're claiming that these are fighters from the Islamic State or the array of other organizations, proxy forces supported by outsiders. But we're going to see much more bloodshed in Syria, I'm afraid to say. In the Philippines, you may have heard that the new strongman president, Rodrigo Duterte, who has called on police to summarily execute drug suspects, whether they're users or dealers, and more than 5,000 people have been killed without the benefit of any political or legal process. And Duterte himself yesterday admitted that when he was the mayor of Davao, that he himself executed, he says, at least three suspected criminals. Now, this admission is a real kind of bizarre bragging by the president of the Philippines. And two members of the Philippine Senate have called for impeachment of Duterte. But the New York Times ran a photo essay last week which depicted, I think, 35 killings at, or it was 41 killings at 35 scenes in 35 days. I don't have the numbers, but they're in that range. And over the weekend, they published a number of comments from Philippine citizens who rejected the notion that they're opposed to what Duterte is doing. They don't care about the law or process. They want drug dealers dead. And this is a really scary process that is spinning out of control. And so because of public opinion, because of the political support that Duterte has, it takes two-thirds of the Senate to remove him from office, it is likely that his killing spree will continue and that he will remain in power. He's gotten tacit approval from Donald Trump, and we exposed the conflict of interest between the Philippine envoy, who is a partner of Trump's, in a development in the Philippines. Kevin Gostola has proven his chops as a journalist again today, reporting on the new federal indictment against Palestinian-American organizer Rosmea O'Day. Last week, we reported that she was granted a new trial. And the prosecutors are going to amp up their indictment by claiming that she was connected to terrorism. And all of this goes back more than 20 years. She was a political activist against Israel in Palestine before she emigrated to the United States in the early 1990s. She was given a green card and resident status by the State Department, but in a bizarre effort, she was later prosecuted for not being forthcoming in her immigration documents about the fact that she had been convicted in Israel and served time in one of its prisons. So I'm linking to the great article that Gostola wrote, and you can find that in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Facebook has announced efforts to curb fake news on its social media platform, and I have to commend them. I think that they're trying to strike a balance here to avoid overt censorship and find ways to flag and alert its users that, hey, this might not be accurate. And just last night, somebody posted on my timeline an article alleged to provide facts about the Pizzagate scandal in Washington and the pedophile allegations. And what I read was just gibberish. It cited things to try to claim that, you know, ordering a cheese pizza is a code word for, you know, child sex exploitation. And I just found it really far-fetched, and I had no way of really expressing that except to call out the person who posted it. So the company is trying to set it up so that it will flag questionable items and alert the reader that external fact-check organizations, including Snopes, have evaluated this and what their finding is. But they don't want to engage in direct censorship, and I think that's a very important standard to maintain. So we'll see how it all plays out. But as I've pointed out, I don't think that the obviously fake news that gets posted on Facebook affected the election. I think it was the propaganda operations of the two campaigns that were spinning desperately on a daily basis. I want to thank you for joining me for my news and comment podcast today. It's available here every day at peterbcollins.com, and you can also find it on YouTube, which makes it available to virtually every device that has a YouTube app. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.